Woe to the bloody city. It is all full of lies and robbery. Its victim never departs. The noise of a whip, the noise of rattling wheels, of galloping horses, of clattering chariots, horsemen charged with bright sword and glittering spear. There is a multitude of slain, a great number of bodies, countless corpses. They stumble over the corpses because of the multitude of harlotries of the seductive harlot, the mystery of sorceries who sells nations through her harlotries and families through her sorceries. Behold, I am against you, says the Lord of hosts. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. I will cast abominable filth upon you, make you vile, make you a spectacle. It shall come to pass that all who look upon you will flee from you and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Where shall I seek comforters for you? Now, I've been trying to emphasize in all of the minor prophet studies that we've had last October and this time that the prophets are about love, loving God, loving neighbor. And after reading these verses that deal with the destruction of Nineveh and that talk about the atrocities committed by the Assyrians and talk about what God's going to do to Nineveh, it might be hard to understand how a passage like this has anything to do with loving God or loving our neighbor. But I think there is a connection. I'm going to try to show you that connection today as we study here from Nahum. And may God so bless us that as a result of today's study, we determine to think things worth thinking and to do things worth doing. Now let me begin like I've begun with the other prophets by giving some historical background to the book. We can date the book with some certainty between 663 B.C. and 612 B.C. The reason for that is that in chapter 3, verse 8, the Battle of Thebes is referenced. That occurred in 663 B.C. And then the destruction of Nineveh, which this book is predicting and pointing to, occurred in 612 B.C. So somewhere between those two dates, apparently, Nahum wrote this book. Last fall, I spent a lesson on the book of Jonah. And in Jonah, the prophet is sent to the city of Nineveh. And he preaches 40 days and God's going to destroy this city. Nineveh repented from the king to the least individual in the city. Greatest gospel meeting ever heard. The entire city turns to God. And God, as a result of that, calls off the hounds, averts his judgment. Nineveh is saved. Jonah was furious. Jonah was disgusted with God's decision. But God gave Jonah a good lecture there in the last chapter of the book. But now, we're a few years beyond Jonah. And maybe you've seen some of those shows about lottery winners, where these people win millions of dollars. And they go out and buy everything that they can think to buy. And then we'll interview these people a year down the road, 2 years down the road, not far down the road. And in many cases, these people who had been incredibly wealthy now are flat broke. They're in more debt than they were ever in their life. Their family won't talk to them. They have no friends. It's a complete reversal of the previous show. And that's what we have with Jonah and Nahum. And it's important that we see the message that God delivers to Nineveh through Nahum. Now, Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. In about 745 B.C., a man by the name of Tiglath-Pileser III became the king of Nineveh. And he began a process of conquest of the west, of the western Levant. And in the process of conquering nations to the west of Assyria, which would be in what we would now call Iraq, there on the Tigris River, he carried off some Israelites around the year 727 BC. Tiglath-Pileser was succeeded by Shalmaneser V, who began the siege of Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, but he died before the siege was completed. The siege was completed by Sargon, who conquered Samaria, carried off the northern kingdom of Israel in 722 BC. Lord Byron memorialized the coming of the Assyrian in his poem on Sennacherib. The Assyrian came down like the wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. And he goes on to talk about the Assyrian coming down. Well, Sargon was murdered in 705 BC, succeeded by Sennacherib, who came back to Canaan. And it was Sennacherib, in fact, we've got the document, the monument he left behind. And on his stele, S-T-E-L-E, is the only picture of a biblical figure that we know about, and that's King Jehu of Judah. But Sennacherib came back and boasted that he shut up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. When the Assyrian came in, the king of Israel, Rezin, and Pekah, the king of Syria, they tried to rally the western nations to stand against the Assyrian. Jotham, the king of Judah, wouldn't go along with them. So Pekah and Rezin attacked Judah. And then Ahaz, Jotham's son, came to the throne. And Ahaz enlisted the aid of Assyria. And the Assyrians came and they dealt with the northern kingdom and took that pressure off of Judah. But they exacted a heavy tribute from Judah as a result. Then Ahaz died and Hezekiah, his son, came to the throne. Hezekiah refused to pay tribute. He put his faith in God. The Assyrian came up, conquered all of the towns of Canaan except for Jerusalem. They blockaded Jerusalem. And then despite what Sennacherib had to say about shutting up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage, Isaiah gives us the rest of the story, the Paul Harvey take on it, by telling us that in one night, 185,000 Assyrians were slain by the angel of the Lord, and Sennacherib lifted the siege and went home, and he died back in Assyria. He was succeeded by Esarhaddon, who was succeeded by Ashurbanipal, who was even more cruel than even the Assyrian standards for cruelty usually were. And there were a couple of others until the fall of Nineveh in 612 B.C. Esarhaddon II, the last ruler of Nineveh, when the Babylonian came up, the Chaldean came up, he gathered his wife, his children, his wealth, he went into the palace and set it on fire, choosing rather to die in the flames than to fall to the Babylonians. Nahum was written in the waning days of the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians were notorious in history for their cruelty. They were totally merciless. They would burn cities. They would make pyramids of human heads. They would fillet the skin off the monarchs of the captured kings. They would choke rivers with the bodies of their victims. And when God judged Assyria, I mean, there was rejoicing throughout the Eastern Mediterranean world. I mean, they made Nazi war atrocities look like a Sunday school picnic. And so God had averted his wrath one time, but now he says your time is up. And you wonder why a book like this is in the Bible. I'm going to tell you why I think it is, and that's going to be what we really talk about this morning. The book of Nahum has a lot to say about the wrath of God. Now, we're talking about the love of God. But the Bible talks about the wrath of God, but what we often miss and have a difficult time wrapping our head around is how the wrath of God is a subset of the love of God. And that's what I'll try to speak to this morning and say something about. So, we're going to look at Nahum. I want to make basically two points. And to make the first, let me ask you to turn to Isaiah chapter 10. And we're going to read verses 5 through 7. Now here's what Isaiah has to say about the Assyrian. Isaiah 10, verse 5. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I will send him against an ungodly nation, and against the people of my wrath I will give him charge, to seize the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Yet he does not mean so, nor does his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and cut off not a few nations. Now that's an amazing statement to me. That brings up one of the great paradoxes in Scripture. Namely, that Assyria, synonymous with cruelty and evil, was an instrument of God, used by God to punish God's own people. God used an evil nation to punish His evil people. Now, Assyria didn't understand that. If you ask Assyria, are you working for Jehovah? They would have said, Jehovah who? No, they didn't think they were carrying out God's agenda. They just saw themselves furthering their own territorial lust, acquiring more money, more treasure. Yet, Isaiah tells us that God used them as His instrument. God can use people whose hearts are completely evil, who have no intention of honoring Him, of glorifying Him. He can use people like that to further His purposes. Do you think God would ever use Al-Qaeda? Do you think God would ever use Russia or Iran? Or any other terrorist? Would he ever use the Palestinians as his instrument to carry out his will? I think so. I think that's what Assyria was all about. God used the worst people around in whose hearts the only thought was that we have come to destroy. Yet God used that wicked nation to accomplish His will. Now, that doesn't mean he sanctioned his evil. That doesn't mean he was endorsing their mindset. What it means is he was using their evil to bring about a righteous purpose. And that's going to take us to what I think is the greater lesson for us here this morning. How God's use of evil, how God's wrath expressed through a nation like Assyria is really meant to bring about a greater redemptive purpose. 2 Corinthians 12 again. I'll go back to Paul's thorn in the flesh. We talked about that the other night. The thorn in the flesh, that cross on which Paul was impaled, as we talked about, had a redemptive purpose. Paul describes it as a messenger of Satan. But God used that thorn to deliver His own message. And the message was that Paul needed to stay humble. And if that verse says anything to us, it tells us that there are times in our life when we are better off with the thorn than without it. We are better off with suffering than with health. We're better off with defeat than with victory. Better off with misfortune than with good fortune. And God tells that to Paul, that you are better off with this problem, whatever it was, with this thorn, than you would be without it. Has anybody here ever been to Ivy Green in Tuscumbia, Alabama, home of Helen Keller? Maybe you've seen The Miracle Worker. What a great story that is. Helen got some disease when she was very small that robbed her of her sight, robbed her of her hearing, and she just grew up a spoiled brat. I mean, she terrorized the whole family. Everything in the Keller, Captain Keller's household was revolved around Helen. You know, containing her tantrums, catering to her every whim and need. And finally, the Kellers realized they needed some help. And they brought in a teacher by the name of Annie Sullivan. Annie's purpose, and she was focused in this purpose, was to deliver Helen from darkness, from isolation, from loneliness. And she comes in and moves in with the family, and she starts to work with Helen, and very quickly she realized Helen's problem were her parents. She would try to discipline Helen, and they would intervene. They would tell her she was just being too hard, that she was too demanding of Helen. Helen would act up. She would discipline Helen. The parents would get upset. They were unwilling to stand against their daughter in order to stand for their daughter. There are times, and maybe this is going to be the most profound thing I say in this lesson, but listen, there are times when for love to be effective, it must be without sympathy. And the Keller parents, Helen's parents, were too weak to do what needed to be done for their daughter. And they were too weak to allow somebody else to do what needed to be done to their daughter. And you remember the story, finally, Annie says, Helen and I are moving out of the house, we're moving into the garden house over here. And it's still there. And she made Helen eat all of her meals in that house, wouldn't let her have contact with the family, and take her out, try to teach her the sign language, take her to the pump, pump the water on her hand, and spell out W-A-T-E-R. And that Attila the Hun, known as Annie Sullivan, was the one that Helen Keller came to thank God for more than anybody else. Imposing that discipline, imposing that harshness, being hard, not because she hated Helen, not because she disliked the girl, but because she was wanting to save the girl. And when we read about God's wrath being expressed against Nineveh, being expressed against Paul, the curse of the cross, we've got to remember that everything God did, He did for a redemptive purpose. Now, God was not excusing the Assyrian. In fact, let me find the verse here I want us to go to. Go back to chapter 3 of Nahum. And what verse was it? Let me see here. Verse 6. Nahum 3, verse 6. God says, not only, Nineveh, am I going to bring you down, I'm going to bury you with garbage, with refuse. I'm going to dig a grave and bury you. Listen, when God buries somebody, they stay buried. There's never been a grave digger like God. He buried Nineveh so completely that 300 years later, when Alexander the Great, went looking for Nineveh, he camped on the very site of Nineveh and didn't have a clue that the city was lying there under his feet. So no, God wasn't excusing the Assyrians' evil. He wasn't ignoring it. He would deal with it. And he dealt with it so completely that that city wasn't found until 1842. So the first thing I'm wanting to say is, God uses evil for His own purposes. Satan is not some co-equal power or entity with God. He is completely under the authority and control of God. So much so that God can take the evil that Satan brings about and use it to redeem people from evil. God's wrath is designed to destroy the very thing that arouses His wrath. Now, having said that, let me talk for a few minutes here about how we deal with God's curse, how we deal with God's wrath. We're not to think of God's wrath as Him losing His temper, flying off the handle, getting out of control, lashing out mindlessly, viciously. That's not what God's wrath is about. God's wrath is an expression of His holiness, of His righteous indignation. God's wrath is what we want when we expect a judge to uphold the law and not to let a criminal off the hook on a technicality. There have been times every one of us has said, you know, where's a cop when you need him? Well, when we talk about God's wrath, we're talking about the law upholder being Johnny on the spot and doing what justice says needs to be done. But there are times when we really don't like that. George Bernard Shaw raged against the doctrine of the cross. He said he'd have nothing to do with the religion that taught that God took pleasure in the death of a child. And he was talking about Christ, God's own child, when he said that. And I think a lot of us share Shaw's thoughts about that in wondering how God can allow certain things to happen. How can He take pleasure in things that transpire in this life? In Galatians chapter 3, verse 13, I mean, Paul said that Christ became a curse for us. And there's just no denying the fact that on the cross, Christ bore the wrath of God. Well, how can God allow a child to be brought under a curse? Because He does. I mean, let's accept that. There is no denying the fact that God allows children, and I'm not one who believes that children are born in sin. And there's a big difference between believing that a child is born bearing Adam's sin and a child is born a sinner, guilty because of something they have done. Now, some of the Jews believe that. You might remember John 9. The apostles asked, Lord, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Some of those nutty Jewish rabbis somehow or other came up with the idea that it was possible for a child to sin before it was born. I don't believe that. I believe that God allows innocent children to fall under a curse, to be the victims of His wrath. When God sent a flood on the world, there were innocent people who perished in that flood. When God sent the Chaldean to destroy Nineveh, there were innocent people who perished in that destruction. Last night, or yesterday, we were looking at Amos chapter 4, where God says to Israel, I have sent drought, I have sent famine, I've sent blight, I've sent pestilence, I've sent destruction. All of those terrible things as punishment for Israel's sins, expression of God's wrath. And you know what? The little children suffered along with the guilty during those times of drought, when there wasn't any water, when disease swept through, when the invader came in. Little innocent children suffered along with everybody else. And we look at such things and we sometimes just rage against God. How in the world could He allow such to happen? And like Shaw, we snarl, and sometimes we sneer, and we declare that if God had half the compassion we've got, He'd never allow something like that to happen. And in thinking along those lines, we're right there with Helen Keller's parents. But what are we to make of all of this? Well, the first thing I want to say is what I've already said, and that is that God allows the innocent to suffer. If He allowed His own Son, the most innocent being ever, to suffer, why do we think He'd spare our children? If He didn't spare His own child, why do we think He'd spare ours? Was it Chesterton who said that the Christian God took His own medicine? God allows the innocent to suffer. God allows the innocent to be the victims of His wrath, of His curse. Second thing, why does God allow that? Because He believes there's something worse than suffering. He believes there's something worse than even innocent suffering. And what's worse than suffering, innocent suffering, is sin and hell. You know, sometimes parents are so heartbroken, they have such a heartache that they're not willing to do what's necessary to save their family from a hellache. Well, God's not like that. And He is no brute. He is not one who delights in the measures He is willing to take to save people from hell, to save people from eternal damnation. And I've got enough faith in God to believe that if He allows the innocent to suffer, the righteous to suffer, that there must be a pretty good reason for it. And that reason is that He is trying to bring sinful humanity to repentance. He's trying to get sinful humanity turned around. They're headed toward hell. He's trying to get them turned around and headed toward heaven. I mean, that's the outline of the book of Romans. First three chapters, Paul says, we're headed for hell. Chapter 4 through chapter 8, here's how you get turned around and headed toward heaven. Chapter 9 to the end, once you're headed toward heaven, stay on that road. Stay headed in that direction. God's willing to take some severe measures to turn men around from hell to heaven. Now, when we're caught in that, when our loved ones, you know, we don't have any problem in a hypothetical way with God's wrath, with God's curse, with God's justice, so long as it doesn't involve any of our loved ones, any of our friends. So long as somebody else, that's all right. But don't let it hit too close to home. Now, when it hits close to home, what should be our reaction? Should we sag our shoulders? Should we be depressed? Should we go around looking like a beaten dog, moping, lashing out in anger against God, lashing out in rage? Remember what James said in James chapter 1, verse 2? He said, brethren, count it all joy when ye fall into divers temptations. James says, whether I understand it or not, and I don't think he's talking stupidity. I don't think he's talking nonsense. James says that it's possible to thank God for hard times. And maybe I can't do that right now in the hard time I'm in. I'm going to guess that there's quite a few people here this morning who are dealing with some hard times, and you're finding it really tough to find any joy in that, to find any cause for rejoicing, for thanking God. And I'm not going to criticize you. I'm not going to lecture you. I'll hug you. I'll stand by you. We'll hold on to each other until such time as we can think noble things of God. Until such time as we can see Him committed to our blessing and to our salvation until such time as we can respond with gallantry to God's severe mercies. And God gives us illustrations of people who did this very thing. You know, we've got the words of Job, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. When God gave Israel their liturgy that involved three feasts in which they were to go up to the temple every year, the Passover, Feast of Harvest, Feast of Weeks, Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, Tabernacles, in one sense, was an agricultural feast where they thanked God for the rain that had come. They prayed for the rain to come. But more than that, the Feast of Tabernacles was a remembrance of one of the hardest periods in Israel's history. The 40 years they spent wandering there in the wilderness, in a completely unsustainable place. And yet God sustained them. He put them in the wilderness. There have been times I've been in the wilderness. There have been times I didn't know how I was ever going to get out of the thicket I was in. A fellow asked Daniel Boone one time, "Have you ever been lost?" Daniel said, "I've never been lost, but I was bewildered one time for 3 days." There have been times I've been bewildered. I just didn't know how God could let me get in the shape I was in, how my life ever got to this point, how I was ever going to move beyond this point. I bet some of you are there right now. That's where Israel was for 40 years. And yet God gave them a feast in which they remember, they built lean-tos out in the yard, moved out of the house, out to the tent there, and lived in for a few days to remember those hard times, because God used those hard times to bring redemption, to get them turned around. They came to understand that their suffering, which included the innocent and the pain they endured, was because of their unbelief that God was willing to take on and challenge through suffering. And I've known people, and I bet if I knew you better, I'd say I know folks at Tingsboro who've been able to rejoice even when they were overwhelmed with sorrow, who've been in the wilderness, who've been under a curse, and yet they hung on. And they put their faith in God. They didn't have the answer to any of the questions that everybody was asking, but they believed God knew what He was doing, even if they didn't. They believed that God was working for their eternal redemption, even if they didn't know how it was working out. And they praised God regardless. What I'm saying is this: God's wrath, God's curse, is always for the purpose of redemption. It is always with heaven in view. It exists to destroy that which keeps people from heaven. God is willing to do more for us than we want Him to do for us sometimes. He's willing to resort to drastic measures if that's what it takes to deal with the evil in our life. And again, I say, if God did not spare His own Son from suffering, we shouldn't think that He would ever spare us. But by not sparing us, somehow or other, He's leading us, and not only us, but others to glory. You know, there are people who have repented because they've seen how a believer dealt with the suffering God dealt them. Turn to Habakkuk chapter 3. I've had to use this verse in my own family here of late. You know, Benjamin Franklin was a deist, but he had a great admiration for the Bible. And when he was the American plenipotentiary to France in 1782, I was only 200 years off. When he was the American ambassador to France, give or take 200 years, the French officials loved to ridicule him. They admired him, but they loved to ridicule him for his admiration of the Bible. And so, one day he decided he was going to do something just to see how much they knew about the Bible. And so the next time they all got together, he started talking about this wonderful ancient document he had come across with a poem in it that just enthralled him. He couldn't get enough of it. And they said, well, Dr. Franklin, tell us what it is. And here's what Franklin read. Pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket and he read, "Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will joy in the God of my salvation." Habakkuk 3, 17 and 18. Now Habakkuk was writing that in a situation very similar to 612 BC when the Chaldean went up to Nineveh. After Nebuchadnezzar dispensed with Nineveh, he turned his sights toward Israel, and 6 years later shows up at Jerusalem. Habakkuk sees the invasion. Habakkuk can't understand how God can use a nation more wicked than Israel to punish Israel. As bad as we are in Judah, we're not as bad as the Babylonian. How can you do this, Lord? In fact, he said, "Lord, you can't do this." God said, "You just watch me." And Habakkuk realizes the judgment is coming. God's wrath is going to fall on Judah. And as he sees the Babylonian approach, he says, "Lord, I'm scared to death." Look at verse 16. "When I heard, my body trembled. My lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered my bones, and I trembled in myself." I'm scared to death of this invasion that's coming. But then he says, though the economy fail, though everybody loses their job, though everybody is chained and has fish hooks put through their nose and are led out of here captive, though life as we know it comes to an end. You know, Peter in 1 Peter 4 talks about the end of all things is at hand. He's not talking about the second coming of Christ. He's talking about a situation like Habakkuk's talking about, where there are times when life as we know it just comes to an end. There'll be people go to the doctor this week, and the doctor will come in and say, "Here's what we found," and life as they have known it will have come to an end. And will never be the same again. Habakkuk says, "Lord, though that happened to Judah, I'm going to say hallelujah anyway." Now how could he do that? How could he be there in the ruins of Jerusalem? Everything destroyed. Life in shambles. And say, "I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation." Count it all joy when you fall in diverse temptations. How could Habakkuk say what James said we ought to say? Here's how. It's one thing to lose the gifts. It's a whole nother thing to lose the giver. There's not a single gift we've been given that we're not going to lose in one way or another. Either through disease, sickness, through friends moving away, through family dying, through the bondage of corruption that we're locked in, through the company going bankrupt. Every temporal gift we've been given, we are going to lose. We can't hang on to any of them. But we can hang on to the giver. And listen, folks, he who gave us gifts the first time can be counted on to give them again. You know, Peter wanted to know, Lord, what's in this for us? What are we going to get out of this? Christ said, Peter, anybody who loses family, houses, fields, friends, jobs, for my sake, is going to be given 100-fold. Job lost it all, ended up with 10 times more than he had before. He who has given us the gifts that we so enjoy and value and prize, when those are taken from us, don't despair. He's going to give us more gifts that are greater, more wonderful than anything we can imagine. When His wrath visits us because we lived in a world under His curse, and when the innocent suffer as a result of His curse, and that suffering takes His gifts away, don't despair. He'll give them back in a greater sense, in a greater way than He ever has given them to us to date. And so we can say hallelujah anyway. We rejoice because of the cross, the greatest travesty of justice, the greatest injustice ever perpetuated, because we see the redemptive side of it. Let's see that in regard to our own suffering. Let's see that God can use vicarious suffering of the innocent today to bring about redemptive purposes. I don't know where this story came from, but there's this story of the souls of all of these children in heaven. And God says to them, now, I need for you to go to earth. Some of you are going to be born into wealthy families where you never have any want, where you never lack anything, where you're surrounded by love, and you grow up in that sort of an environment. But some of you are going to be born into terrible situations where you suffer from day one, where you're sick, where you are deformed, where you don't have a loving support system. Who's willing to go and suffer for me in that kind of situation? Of course, all the little baby souls, I will. They were willing to go because they knew it was the will of God. You know, we're told that God's patience lasts a lifetime. The psalmist says, God's wrath is but for a moment, but His favor lasts forever. God's wrath is not an innate part of His nature. The innate parts of His nature are always there. They never cease to exist. But His wrath is not always there. His favor lasts for a lifetime. Somebody says, well, I'm not going to do right today. I'm not going to get right with the Lord today. And maybe not tomorrow, but before I die. Well, if you know your death date, maybe that's okay to think that way. God's favor will last a lifetime. If you don't know your death date, maybe you better take advantage of the time that you have and allow all that God is doing to get you headed toward heaven, to work in your life. So, read Nahum. And better appreciate what God is trying to do with His wrath, what He is trying to do when He judges, when He chastens, and have a greater, larger, more glorious conception of God as a result. Thank you for your attention this morning.